Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we sometimes believe conspiracy theories, even when they sound absurd to everybody else? From false stories that Jews planned world domination, to the terrors of McCarthyism, to swirling rumors that the U.S. government played a direct role in the destruction on 9/11, there has been no shortage over the past century of alternative explanations for major events. My guest today says there are reasons for that. David Aronovich is a journalist and columnist for the Times newspaper in the U.K. His new book is called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
You started thinking about all this when you were working with a bright, capable, educated young producer who seriously believed that the lunar landings were a hoax.
So he said, yeah. I mean, this was the origin of the whole thing. We were working in Tunisia on a program for the main broadcaster out here, the BBC, and we were thrown together. We had to trust each other because we were trying to do things without the secret police of Tunisia seeing us do them. And we were on this long drive, and he said, David, you know, what about the moon landings in the way that people do when they're talking to each other? And I said, yeah, sure, I saw them as a kid. And he said, well, you didn't, you know. And I said, what do you mean? And he then told me the whole thing, which a lot of people have heard now, how the photographs weren't right and there should have been pictures of stars, but there weren't, and the flags were waving and there's no wind on the moon and so on. And he said, so that just all goes to show that actually the story was faked, and therefore the moon landing was faked, probably so that America could get to the moon before the end of the decade, as had been promised. He said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, I don't know the specific arguments on each of your cases, but I'm sure there are some. But it just seems to me that it would be harder to fake a moon landing than actually land on the moon.
Yeah.
If you think of all the thousands of people you'd have to pay off and have to keep quiet for the rest of their lives and so on. And I also said to him, you know, and I also saw a movie, Capricorn One, and this was the basis of it. And I think Kevin, this guy, was just a bit too young to have seen the movie. But it just started me thinking why he would want to believe that, why it was a better story to him that people hadn't landed on the moon and that NASA had faked it than the heroic story of how people actually had landed on the moon, why this alternative was better. So I just started looking at the things that people believed, and it turned gradually into looking at what we call conspiracy theories, the idea that there is some hidden hand which is behind and secretly behind some of the major moments in history, which covers itself up and so on, but nevertheless which directs things. And I found that increasingly interesting. What I looked at in the book is a wide variety of different types of examples of conspiracy theory from different places. What is different about them, and what is the same about them, and what they tell us about the way in which people work, and also what their impact has been on how history has developed.
I was really struck, David, by the fact that a lot of these tend to originate not with wild, sort of mentally disturbed people, but with intelligent individuals.
You're so right. It's absolutely true. I mean, a subtitle for this book could have been Why Very Clever People Believe Very Dumb Things. and it's absolutely true. The conspiracy theories typically emerge from the educated classes. They are the province of students and academics and lawyers and doctors and people like that, not of other parts of society. A lot of the people that I've met who believe in conspiracy theories are incredibly bright people. So it's just not right to say it's the province of lunatics and stupid. I mean, you know, you can have some lunatics as well. That's perfectly true. But I wouldn't say that that was generally true. And I think it interesting. I mean, it is almost as if the other thing you might have said, which would have been true, which struck, was that the substantial proportion of those people who advocate conspiracy theories are guys. Women are much, much less likely to. You wouldn't believe how many times here in Britain women have come up to me and said, I'm buying your book for my boyfriend.
What accounts for that, do you think?
Well, I guess part of it may be that there's still a greater cultural expectation on the part of men to look at how society and government is run, if you like, the kind of the structural picture. And it may be that the conspiracy theories that women have had a bigger tendency to believe have been more those to do with health, you know, like the idea that vaccinations have gone wrong and so on, that are more kind of personal and more related to the family. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just a kind of observation about the way in which people do things. I mean, one of the things you might say, and I said in the book, is you might say that conspiracy theories were hysteria for men.
Yeah, it is an interesting sort of challenge to authority, and the very blind spot that keeps them from realizing that these things are often quite ridiculous is their ability or their attempt to sort of make sure that they're not having the wool pulled over their eyes by some authority figure.
Absolutely. I mean, a big part of this, the psychology of it, is the ability to say to somebody else, you may be taken in by the official version and the things that they want you to believe, but I'm not, because I'm really clever and I'm really smart and I'm quite special. I mean, that's quite an important part of the sell of a conspiracy theory, is the idea that you have understood something that the majority of people just don't get.
And there is, of course, the vexing reality that there have been some real conspiracies over the years.
Sure. No, I mean, there have been. It's worth reflecting on what those conspiracies actually are. And incidentally, as I looked at quite a lot of the things that even I had thought were conspiracies, they had a slight disappointing tendency to become not conspiracies. I mean, I'll give you two quick examples. I'd always believed that the American government had lied about the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964 in order to give itself an excuse for bombing North Vietnam. I mean, I was very little at the time, but that's how history was told to me. And it turns out, I mean, it was pretty much that actually they just got it wrong. They'd been fired on a few days earlier, and they thought they'd been fired on again. And so it was what we call in Britain a cock-up. Rather than anything else, it was a kind of series of mistakes that came out of the, you know, the incredible difficulty of decision making at the time. So that was, and the second example was, it's often taught here in schools and college that in 1933, just after he'd been made chancellor, the German Reichstag, the parliament building, was set on fire, and there was one guy who was caught doing it. And the Nazis then tried to pin the blame on the communists, and some communists went on trial. And it was then said it was the Nazis who'd done it themselves. And it's often taught, even in schools here, that the Nazis did it themselves. And looking into that, it becomes fairly clear that the Nazis didn't. And actually, it was the one guy who said he did it all the way through who set fire to the Reichstag. In other words, these conspiracies tend not to, even the conspiracies you think tend not to be the case. So you then look at the things which you are real conspiracies, which we know about. And they tell you quite a lot, don't they? I mean, Watergate in particular, if you think about what Watergate actually was, here are a group of people hired by the White House, the plumbers, led by people like Liddy, who are really useless. I mean, one of the first things that he does when he gets into the White House is to get his team to watch a film show of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will from the Nazi era in order to kind of get them in the mood. I mean, this is not a guy you really want to be kind of walking around doing stuff for you. They then go and want to get some information out of the Watergate offices of the Democratic Party. And what happens? Who catches them effectively? A security guard who calls the police. Now, in any decent conspiracy theory, the security guard and the police are toast, aren't they?
Yeah. You know? They've been bought out long ago.
Yeah, but not in reality. They're actually caught. And what actually, in the end, catches Nixon as having known about it is the fact that he can't even efficiently wipe some tapes that he himself has caused to be made. I mean, that really tells you an awful lot about real-life conspiracy, doesn't it? Which is that as soon as it gets to an order of complexity beyond one or two, the whole thing begins to fall apart.
So why are these conspiracy theories more, I don't know if the word is comforting to us, than the just messy chaos of real life?
I think you've just expressed it really well. They are comforting in this way for some people. If you believe that, I mean, we know that our lives are full of tragedy, accident, you know. When a friend of ours has a traffic accident, we don't suddenly look around and say, oh, I wonder why, you know, I wonder who made that happen. you say, you know, it's a terrible accident, but it's appalling. But if somebody offers to you a version of the world in which accident and messiness is taken away, and you say, yes, there is behind everything an overwhelming intelligence that causes this to happen and that organized for it to happen, in a way, that's more comforting than believing that everything is accidental. And we could take another example. John Farmer's recent book about 9/11, he was a guy who advised, there was counsel to the 9/11 Commission. And his book more or less says that from the moment the first hijacker got on the first plane to the moment that Flight 93 crashed in Pennsylvania, there wasn't a second when the United States government was anywhere close to getting a handle on the situation. There just wasn't. They tried to pretend afterwards that there was, but there wasn't. A lot of people would rather believe that there was a really good organizing intelligence in the, you know, in the government, even if it was for bad, than believe that actually the country could simply not be prepared for an event like that and never be in control of it. So in that way, it's kind of, it can be more comforting to believe that.
I don't know whether this story has reached you in the UK or not, but there is a famous evangelist here called Pat Robertson. And
We heard of him.
Yeah. And you heard about the story and what he said about Haiti?
Was it one of his versions whereby he said it was because it was, doesn't he usually say it's because God was angry with somebody?
Yeah, well, he said that the Haitians made a deal with the devil, and therefore this was the repercussion. And it's not exactly, I know this is somewhat outside of conspiracy theory because, you know, trying to discuss theology and the will of God takes us far off topic. But I wonder if you can talk about the similarities that a story like that, where he needs to really organize this senseless tragedy, how that relates to other kinds of conspiracy theories.
I think actually you put it extremely well. I think there is that kind of relationship. I mean, what we know about the Haitian earthquake, I mean, and it is a staggering thing. I mean, I was listening to your news just before we came on air, and hearing the figure 200,000, again, 200,000 people killed so quickly because of a fairly high-level earthquake at a fairly shallow level in a particular place. No wonder some people would rather believe that there was some intelligence lying behind it than that this is the kind of thing that can happen. I mean, there are parts of the United States which are waiting on great major seismic events that they know pretty much will happen at some time or another. So, you know, maybe one can comfort oneself by thinking there's got to have to be some sort of great intelligence. The ancient Greeks, of course, put this into the lap of the gods. They said the gods, who were capricious, but nevertheless, the gods organized to do it. And there's a bit of sort of Pat Robertson believing in the ancient Greek gods there, really, isn't there? I mean, there's sort of some kind of... So it is. It can be, I think, a belief form. It is the notion that there is purpose always behind it all, that there, instead of there being a kind of ridiculous figure like Lee Harvey Oswald, who tried to shoot somebody before and passed whose place of work by bad luck, they routed in your city the presidential motorcade. You know, the immediate reactions to that killing in parts of America was, what kind of country have we become where guys like Lee Harvey Oswald can exist? And then after that, people begin to say, no, it's a deep, dark conspiracy. The FBI, the CIA, the Russians, the Mafia, the Cubans, somebody has organized for this to happen. Because if that's the case, then actually we're not that kind of country. Hmm. We are merely the victims of a conspiracy, which is somehow more comforting than the reality.
David Aronovich is my guest. His new book is called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David Aronovich. He is a columnist for the Times newspaper and author of the new book Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. David, after having examined many of these, did you find that proponents of conspiracy theory pretty much always actually believe what they're saying?
Oh, yeah. I, on the whole, I have no reason to doubt the sincerity of the majority of conspiracy. There was a subset of them I was slightly more worried about, which was people have a slight tendency to believe, maybe more than even a slight tendency to believe the conspiracy theories that implicate their political opponents and not believe the ones which are about their political, the people they support politically. I mean, let's take the classic example of 9/11 and then the Obama birth certificate.
Yeah.
By and large, the people who tended to believe that George Bush was so evil as to bring down the Twin Towers himself tended to be more Democrats. And overwhelmingly, the people who believe that Obama's family had somehow arranged to have him made an American when he wasn't one tended overwhelmingly to be Republicans. And you do wonder sometimes whether some of these people are aware of their own, if you like, their own partiality, their own partisanship. But by and large, the people that I've met and I've heard talking about it are very convinced by their own arguments, and some of them passionately convinced by their own arguments. And I had people come up to me about 9/11, look me in the eyes, a young guy, you know, really honest, and, you know, my heart has gone out to him. And he said to me, David, he said, I don't understand why you're doing this. And I said, well, because, obviously I think it's true, but his sincerity was not in doubt. And I think one of the troubles that we get into increasingly is imagining that just because we disagree with somebody, they're not sincere. By and large, people are sincere, and by and large, people do what they think is the right thing. It's just that sometimes they're wrong.
You know, the 9/11 example is fascinating to me because much of the world watched that happening live on television, and yet it's still very difficult for some people to accept the sort of official version of events.
Sure, and actually their theories have become incredibly elaborate. I mean, and this is one of the facets of the internet has helped, which is it's allowed the coming together of virtual communities of people swapping information and kind of, if you like, creating and recreating an atmosphere of conspiracism for each other and arguments and so on, within which ideas and so-called facts take hold incredibly quickly, which is one of the reasons also why 9/11 conspiracy theories have mutated so quickly. I was one of the early things that 9/11 conspiracy theorists people were arguing were that the calls made from the aeroplanes to the ground were faked.
Right, right.
So I found myself on a radio station in Los Angeles with one of the people who'd made the Loose Change movie, which is one of the most popular conspiracy movies ever made. Some intelligent young guys have put it together. I was on with one of those, and I said, well, you know, what about this mobile phones thing? Because it's been, you know, clearly proved since you said it, that X, Y, and Z. And he said, oh, he said, you're just nitpicking. I said, well, you know, it wasn't me that raised the issue of mobile phones. He said, well, he said, nobody cares about that anymore. He said, the main and most important thing is this nanothermite that they have found at the scene of 9/11. Nanothermite being a kind of mysterious substance, which they now claim, which a chemist or two who are 9/11 conspiracy supporters claim to have found. And, you know, once that's been disposed of, there will be another theory. And yet, despite disposing of all these theories, I thought all the time that these people are nevertheless absolutely convinced that Bush and the Republican administration were so wicked, so evil, and so incredibly clever that they could pull off something like this.
Did you happen to encounter in all this research, David, any sort of reformed conspiracists, people who, who no longer believed what they used to believe?
Yeah, me. I was brought up believing that John F. Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy. Of course I was. Mm-hmm. Whole generations were. I mean, you know, there's the famous Woody Allen line, which was, you remember, I'm busy at work making a non-fiction version of the Warren Commission report. when you make a joke like that, it can only work if your whole audience understands what you're saying and agrees with you, right? So Woody Allen's generation and then those younger than him, I'm fortunately a fair bit younger than him still, but nevertheless, if people who were young during the 60s and 70s and so on, we're just brought up believing this. There was the magic bullet. Remember the magic bullet? It couldn't possibly have gone through JFK and then through Connally and come out the way it did and so on. We were taught. I mean, I'd never looked at it, but all the people who I regarded as authority figures around me believed that that was true. So it was only really in the last sort of 7 or 8 years when I began to look at it myself. And obviously, you know, the science has moved on a bit since those early days, and you can now do pretty accurate computer reconstructions based on Zapruder and the actual position of people's in the car to work out what actually happened, that you can see that there is no magic bullet and so on. And once there's no magic bullet, there really is no need to believe in a conspiracy. A conspiracy becomes a kind of, you know, an additional complication for which there is no evidence.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. David Aronovich is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Let's go on the phones to Chris in Richardson. Hello, Chris.
Yes. Well, he already kind of talked about the first thing I was going to bring up, which was the Obama birth certificate conspiracy theory. So I'm going to change my question a little bit. I'd like to hear him comment on kind of the value of conspiracy theories as propaganda in today's political discourse, because, you know, there's the Obama birth certificate conspiracy theory on one side, but the other side was, I like all the details about the 9/11 conspiracies, but I was thinking of the conspiracy theory that the invasion of Iraq was all a plan by Dick Cheney, sort of in this complex scheme to increase oil prices and fill the pockets of him and his buddies. But it seems to me that, you know, these conspiracies are very useful for certain political factions, and I'd like to hear him talk about whether or not he thinks that certain sides are pushing these conspiracies as a way to move their agenda forward. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. I mean, it's a really good question. One of the things there is such a thing, I suppose, as a low-level conspiracy theory, which a lot of us are prone to a lot of the time, which is, if you like, to give too much emphasis to the enemy and the enemy's cleverness and so on, and to imagine, and in a way, maybe that was done with Saddam and so on. It's pretty clear that the British government, certainly the American government, believed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and anyway, believed that Saddam would do something terrible at some time in the future. And I mean, there's the question to the degree to which people saw Iraq as unfinished business after the first Gulf War of 1991 and so on. And you don't really need an explanation that involves Cheney making money. I mean, not least because America lost so much money in Iraq, and invasions are always very expensive business. You know, Cheney is a guy who doesn't do things so that he makes money out of the public. He does them out of conviction. The problem, if there is a problem with Cheney, is what he's convinced by, not what he's hiding, if you see what I mean. It's all out there in plain view, really. I think part of the problem does lie in us always assuming that the other side has bad faith, you know, that they are, as I say, kind of particularly evil. I think of how some of the very same people who believe in the Obama birth certificate thing and push that were the same people pushing the idea that Bill Clinton, very same people, had murdered or had somehow murdered his friend and White House counsel Vince Foster, if you remember that far back. And one of the interesting things about that was one of the first major internet conspiracy theories. It was in the early days of the internet. Can we even remember the early days of the internet? It seems like years ago, doesn't it? But it's not so long. And that was when those sorts of things really began to take off.
I'm wondering why we tend to magnify the omnipotence of our enemies, whether political or international. Even if you look at, and this is not exactly literature, but, you know, slasher movies where the killer has all this power and is always able to keep on going, and we're just sort of powerless human beings. Why do we go there?
Yeah, I've always wondered why people watch horror movies. You always look and the first person opens the door to the dark room and you say, why are you even thinking of doing
just
that?
Just get in your car and go.
Yeah, and there's an enormous attraction, obviously, to people who don't, who like the thrill. Let me posit a couple of, you know, suggest a couple of possibilities. The one is that if you say that there is a power which is an organizing power for evil, which can do, which is incredibly clever, it does at least suggest the possibility that there would be such a power for good. In other words, the world can be organized. This group will do it for evil and they're very clever, etc., but maybe this group could do it for good. Whereas, in fact, actually, the difficulty is, as we discover over, you know, making big international agreements to do things that we know need to be done, it's really hard to organize the world in any kind of way at all. There are so many kind of cross currents. But the other possibility was suggested to me by a friend of mine who's a psychoanalyst, and it has to do with what we call paranoia. And we're talking about whether conspiracy theories were about paranoia. They're out to get me, you know, a bit like the sort of McCarthyist thing. And what he said was, well, you should look at what the role of paranoia sometimes is, because you find amongst people who are most personally paranoid, you know, like an old person who believes, who lives on their own, who believes there's somebody back at their apartment who might want to do them damage, or somebody's been coming in and moving things around, that actually what the paranoia might be disguising is a much, much worse fear, mm-hmm. which is the fear that nobody cares about them at all. And that actually the belief that somebody's in their flat apartment to do them harm is actually more comforting than the thought that nobody thinks about them. Susan Sontag once said, didn't she, I admire paranoia, I envy paranoids because they always think somebody's thinking about them.
Yeah.
It's a variant on Oscar Wilde's old dictum that the only thing worse than being talked about was not being talked about. And so in that sense, kind of, if you populate the world with people who mean you harm, at least they're thinking about you.
Is there any difference, David, in the way these things spread in societies like yours and like our own, where there is a free press and we have the expectation that there will be a great deal of transparency and accountability from our governments, as opposed to places where everyone sort of understands that there's only one official account and it may or may not be true?
Yeah, I mean, well, by and large, in places where the government organizes all the media, there's a sort of really interesting relationship. I mean, the default position of everybody is that what the government tells you in that situation is untrue. It's just how they believe it. But nevertheless, the way in which the world is presented, nevertheless, is absorbed by the population. So the Iranian government, for instance, is very conspiratorially minded, you know, blaming the British and American governments for the demonstrations in Tehran after the elections last summer. Saying that the murder of that young woman by a militiaman was actually secretly organized by British intelligence, that kind of thing, very, very kind of conspiracist. And I dare say a large number of Iranian people believe it. And in a very locked-down society, maybe there is a greater tendency to believe in conspiracies because there's not the free play of ideas. But it is interesting, nevertheless, how in a society as free and open as America, nevertheless, there is such a cultural emphasis on conspiracy theory over time. You know, in other words, it can exist in both places, and that suggests that there is an overriding desire for the ordering of the universe that conspiracy theory gives you, which is quite human rather than specifically cultural. It's almost in that sense like religion. Religion of one sort or another exists everywhere. Now, they are, of course, mutually exclusive. You can't both believe that God made the world in 7 days and also believe that, you know, Zeus, whatever went before Zeus did it. You can't believe both of them. But what's interesting is that nearly everywhere somebody believes some version of that. And the British biologist Lewis Wolpert suggested that maybe and it's just a conjecture. Maybe people were what he called hardwired by their need as toolmakers for causality, that one thing causes another, that they couldn't bear a situation now whereby they can't map out a causality. And he attributed religion to that, but you could say that conspiracy theory fits the bill as well. We're looking all the time for a better cause. One thing causes another, and conspiracy theory answers that desire.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Kathy in Arlington. Hey, Kathy.
Hi. My comment was that I think that conspiracy theories can serve a beneficial purpose. They allow us to see things that, you know, I would never have thought of these conspiracy theories, but once you hear them, you think, oh, well, I should be wary of these things and watch the government when they try to do certain policies.
Sort of cautionary tales.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that, David?
I think it's, I sympathize with it, but I think there's a real problem with it. And let me give you a small example of something that happened here in Britain. It's happened in a kind of way in the States as well, which is the controversy over the MMR vaccination, the measles, mumps, and rubella
right.
vaccination. We had a big brouhaha happen here when one doctor and a couple of people published something in one of the medical journals. And a lot of people believed the suggestion he appeared to make that there was a cause, that there was some causal link between the MMR vaccination and autism. All the major scientists, and of course the government scientists and so on, said this isn't true. And a lot of people then said, oh yeah, but they would say that because they're the government and they're always trying to do this and they're always trying to do that. Exactly the kind of what you can't mark automatic skepticism that you're describing. And the result over time was that we lost what we call our herd immunity to measles. We began to get a measles, which was a disease we thought we'd eradicated. People have actually died from it, and it has taken the best part of 10 years now to get back to the situation whereby everybody now understands that that original paper was entirely wrong. So what I'm saying is that it is a fault. Skepticism has to be something you apply to everything and not just to government. You even have to apply skepticism to your skepticism about government, if you see what I mean, because otherwise what you can end up is saying is, well, maybe there's something to that story that the Jews want to control the world, or maybe there's
something. Let me have you pause right there. We have to take a quick break. David Aronovich is with us. The book is called Voodoo Histories. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist David Aronovich. His new book is called Voodoo Histories, The Role of Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. Now, before the break, you were talking about the value of skepticism, of our own skepticism. Ultimately, firm belief in a conspiracy sort of nullifies our ability to look critically at our own assumptions.
Completely. I mean, that's one of the things I find most interesting. People will often say, I'm a skeptic because I believe in conspiracy theory because I'm a skeptic. But very rarely is there a genuine skepticism. What tends to happen is they say anything the government says is not true. Well, if that's the position you take, that's not really skepticism. But not only that, they then tend to say almost anything which says why the government says what the government says is not true isn't true, I'm prepared to believe. Well, that's not skepticism. That's the worst kind of credulity. Really. I mean, true skepticism is a real interrogation, insofar as you're able to, of the facts in front of you and the asking of difficult questions. But sometimes, quite often, difficult questions can be answered. I think a real skeptic accepts that. And I think this book is, I like to think it is, part of what you might call a skeptical fight back against all that sort of anti-science, anti-rationality, conspiracy theorist type and pseudo-history type, which has really kind of invaded culture in the course of the last 15 or 20 years, and which I think there are a number of people who are trying. Over in Britain, we've got a guy called Ben Goldacre, who's written a brilliant book called Bad Science, looking at some of the fads in science and the claims that are made. You know, people who pass off ridiculous diets as if they were scientifically valid when they have no validity at all. People who make ridiculous claims about the dangers of vaccination and so on. It's not to say that you shouldn't be skeptical, you shouldn't ask serious questions, but there are quite a few snake oil salesmen out there, particularly in the field of science and so on, and I think this is, if you like, part of the fight back.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mita in Dallas. Hi, Mita.
Yes, hi there. My question was about urban legends, and I wanted to see if the guest had some of the same research applied to that as well, or if there's a different set of motivations that sort of creates the genesis of those.
I think it's a really good question. I think that there is a strong... I mean, one function of conspiracy theories, it seems to me, is those of us who've, you know, been in the golf club bar or at the bar or at dinner or something like this, and somebody's come forward and said, you know, you never guess, or here's the real story, and so on. It quite often functions in the same way that gossip used to function in days when we all used to live on the same street forever and we knew all the neighbors, and somebody would find out that, you know, maybe the woman at number 42 was seeing rather more of the postman than she ought to be. And you'd be the person who had that information. You had the capacity to pass it on. And it would be passed on with kind of goggle eyes and a sort of mock shocked but actually delighted look. And I think, you know, urban myth goes in very much the same way. Here is an incredibly beautifully rounded story. And not only that, but I'm telling you that it's true. Of course, it didn't happen to me, but it happened to the sister of a friend of mine, and I can vouch for the fact that it's true. And these urban myths then spread around. And they spread around precisely because they fulfill this delightful need to be the teller of the story. I think, actually, in some ways, good jokes can function in much the same sort of way. It makes you... a social success for the moment when you're actually telling the story.
You've got the floor.
You've got the floor.
We have an email here from Richard in Fort Worth who asks, have you considered the possibility that individuals with a low tolerance for ambiguity are particularly drawn to conspiracy theories?
I'm not totally sure how we would measure it, but I think that must be true. I mean, it just simply must be true that if you like greater levels of certainty... maybe if you think that the political and cultural world should follow the same rules as the scientific world, but irritatingly don't, and you do want a certainty. I mean, I remember once I have been, amongst other things, an editor of a current affairs program here in Britain, and we had on the Archbishop of York, who was one of the major figures in the Church of England, and he was under criticism for having doubt. And he turned around to the presenter on the show and he said, does it ever occur to you, he said to our presenter, that the lust for certainty is itself a sin? In other words, you know, demanding always that you be absolutely certain about everything can lead you into some pretty dangerous and sort of rather unhuman pathways. Doubt is in many ways the natural human condition. So I think the answer to the question is almost certainly yes.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Brad in Mansfield. Hello, Brad.
Hi. I was just wondering if, how we was talking about religions earlier, if they are mutually exclusive, conspiracy theories or religion is mutually exclusive, one or the other.
The very fact that your leading 9/11 conspiracy theorist is a professor of comparative theology and a very religious man seems to suggest that not only are they not mutually exclusive, but that actually one can sometimes suggest the other. I mean, not inevitably, but they can very slightly. I mean, after all, the belief in a plan and that somebody has a plan for everything can be common between religion and conspiracy theories. I don't want, you know, one is always worried about offending people at this point. unnecessarily and so on. But there could be some kind of relation in that way. But there is the possibility also that a deep belief in conspiracy theories actually could replace religious belief. In other words, it is what some people might do instead of having religious belief. And I can see that that could happen. And I can see that that can happen almost in the real passion and sincerity of some of the younger people in the 9/11 truth movement has, I think, a sort of religious quality to it.
Well, it is interesting, and certainly acceptance of scientific knowledge has not negated faith for very many people, and people don't have a problem with explaining the world in two different ways. But it does seem that in antiquity, when we had only to sort of look at supernatural forces to explain the things we didn't understand, you don't hear as many reports of people getting together and thinking that someone else was out to get them. It was sort of explained as the will of God.
Yeah, I guess that's partially true, although... In my mind's ear, I hear somebody saying Julius Caesar.
Huh, yeah.
You know, I hear Cassius and Brutus and et cetera sharpening the knives in the behind the Senate House, getting ready to plunge them. Although it has to be said, although that was a conspiracy, it was a very open conspiracy, and nobody denied it, and nobody tried to hide it.
But that was an actual conspiracy, as opposed to a theory.
Exactly. I mean, if it was a conspiracy theory, they'd probably say that Julius Caesar had planned it himself and it wasn't him who'd been killed. It was somebody else pretending to be him.
What do you think, David, as a member of the media, about there are a significant number of people who instantly distrust what they're told by journalists?
I think that the habit of skepticism should certainly extend to us as journalists. Mm-hmm. I think that we are an important and deeply flawed profession. We have a job. You and I think, listening to the tone of this program, are lucky. I'm lucky because I'm able to be relatively serious. And you're lucky because you're able to explore complex issues and so on. But a lot of our colleagues are not in such a fortunate position. They have to turn out stories. They have to have front pages. They have to have headlines. They have to turn it round all the time. They have to get ratings. One of the reasons why some conspiracy theories spread in the way they do is because publishers know that conspiracy theory books sell and will commission them, and people know that they will make documentaries, so people commission those too. And quite often the people who commission them really don't care whether they're true or not. I mean, they're the people who don't, the writers might believe it, but the people who commission them don't care. So I would say that there are very good reasons to choose your information sources carefully. How information is assessed is becoming, in the internet age, really one of the most important questions for young people in the developed world that there is. And I think we don't pay enough attention to it because we just haven't realized how much the world has changed.
Where's the line for you between what amounts to harmless nonsense in conspiracy theories? I'm thinking no one is really hurt if they don't believe the lunar landing actually happened.
Sure.
And that which is really quite dangerous.
Although Buzz Aldrin wouldn't agree with you. I gather that the last person to ask him whether it was really true that it was that the moon landing was faked actually got what do you call it? One in the kisser, but that may be not be true. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the chapters in the book is about how Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code came to make the statement at the beginning: these things are facts, which weren't facts at all. They were complete fantasies. They had absolutely no basis in truth. You know, the Priory of Zion has been guarding the bloodline of Christ, but no, it hasn't. It was actually made up in 1956. And because it tells you something about people's habit of mind. But it's true. Although it led to a huge case in London, in which the authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail tried to sue Dan Brown and lost and ended up paying millions. The only people who really suffered out of that was them. The trouble is, unless you have a fairly kind of scrupulous regard for the truth, you're on a kind of slippery slope. Yes, it's sort of fun, but if you can kind of believe that, you can believe something else. So In the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the book on which the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code is partially based, they say, yes, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is not, it may not be, it's not about Jews, it's not true about Jews, but it is an important document and it's true about Freemasons. Well, no, it's a complete forgery. And so you can see how even in this harmless exchange, they kind of, by accepting nonsense, they begin to allow little bits in that actually could be slightly harmful. I don't want to overdo that because some conspiracy theories are so much more damaging than others, and some are just at the levels of urban myth, you know, kind of really intriguing little tales which we like to retell but which aren't true.
Is there, beyond just the, you know, urban legend site Snopes.com, is there a sort of clearinghouse for looking at these things, or are they taken apart by people who are experts in the particular subjects?
No, there isn't a clearinghouse, and one of the things that I've thought about doing maybe is starting up a clearinghouse for this. I mean, there are some extremely good sites. There are very good. There's one very good site on the Kennedy assassination. There's a very, very good site, in fact, a couple of very good sites on 9/11, 9/11 myths, and it's one of the best, where one by one they take up the sort of things which 9/11 conspiracy people say and subject them to scrutiny. And there's the Skeptics Dictionary site. The James Randi Educational Foundation. James Randi has done some fantastic work in the debunking field. I mean, he really is a kind of hero of true skepticism, and long may he continue to be so. But nobody's actually brought them together, and maybe it's about time they were.
Was there any part of you that was disappointed to let go of your childhood conviction?
Oh, yes.
That the Kennedy assassination wasn't real?
No, absolutely. I mean, some of these things... You know, the idea that Hitler set fire to the Reichstag himself, when I discovered that probably wasn't true, I was very reluctant to give it up. And actually, I got accused of all kinds of things where some people were so angry that I should say that Hitler wasn't guilty of this particular thing that they made it sound as if I was saying that he wasn't guilty of all the other things. And I said, these things don't follow. He was guilty of, you know, Nazism. He was guilty of the legislation against the Jews and ultimately for the Holocaust, but he didn't do the Reichstag fire. And it was hard kind of letting that one go. You know, it was like some of these things are like comfort blankets, and people get very cross when you take them away.
Do you think that we're going to get better at seeing these things for what they are?
My friend... Dr. Ben Goldacre, who runs who wrote the Bad Science book about the trouble with science, he's very pessimistic about it. He thinks that this sheer proliferation of information. I mean, I'll give you a small example.
You know, I'm sorry. I've left you absolutely no time for the example. I apologize
sorry.
For
it's
that.
It's been fantastic.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. David Aronovich has a new book called Voodoo Histories, The Role of the Conspiracy Theory in Shaping Modern History. David, it's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it too.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.